thank you for coming to this discussion today.
Yeah, I can't remember. We spent one Christmas there.
I hope everybody is refreshed.
With
a little work and a little rest. But this is a very interesting day in the history of
evangelical
church in America. Where, do you know something about the single roster?
I'm dying of lack of contact. I wish I knew what was going on.
I think today is the day.
And I have no way of finding out.
But the ELCA at Churchwide Assembly in New Orleans will vote to have a single roster
of Word and Service Ministries.
That's right.
Which includes the ELCA deaconesses, the Solchitzin ministry, and the diaconal ministers. And they're going to change to a single roster. We think they are.
Okay.
That's the proposal. It is not in any of any of the places where I'm able to look, there's nothing that says it. I haven't looked very much either, though. So.
Do you have internet access?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, keep looking.
Yeah. I'll let you know when it.
Because I don't have a dog in this fight, except I have friends who have dogs in this fight.
Right.
No, it'd be a great recognition of ministries that have carried this church for years and years. How this church has really exploded and expanded around the world because especially of the ministry of women. And Ames, of course, women pastors, and in many other churches. As you know, the church in the world is growing at a rather astounding level.
Could you define what you mean by the church?
Well, I mean the Christian church. Let's say the Christian Roman Catholics, but among those growing the fastest, of course, are the Lutherans. As I had talked about yesterday, you know, this little church that I was there when they began with 40,000 people, now it's up to, I don't know, 7 or 8 million Lutherans in this one church in Ethiopia. But it's being dwarfed by, of course, some of the other churches in Tanzania. And the larger churches, of course, are in Indonesia. These are of the Lutheran churches. But it is said, Philip Jenkins of Princeton says by the year 2050, the Christian faith will have grown by 2 billion members. I mean, it's astounding to us where in the North Atlantic region, things are shrinking. And church participation, even seminaries, the statistics are the other way. But globally, it's just the opposite. You know, it's very interesting. The Muslims are growing too, maybe 1.7 billion in the next 30 years. But not quite as fast as the Christians. I mean, this is what the Pew Research Foundation is telling us. But when you go to these countries, it is rather amazing thing to behold. You can't build the church buildings fast enough in many different countries to hold the people. And of course, in many countries, they don't need church buildings at all. In some of these countries, not all, women leadership has been key. And if you have had any history in Latin America, Central America, you know that in the Roman Catholic Church, through the Second Vatican Council and the bishops' meetings that have followed, the rise of liberation theology, the leadership has gone to women. The women religious, the women leaders, and if you go to little towns in Honduras or Guatemala, you see those communities of people gathered in the homes, gathered in the shops. They meet to pray, to sing, and to work together to bring change to their village, to bring change to the school. They've been seen as a threat, of course, by the government, and the lay catechists have been killed. A lot of the women leaders have been killed. You know, there's four from the U.S. Those wonderful leaders of the Roman Catholic Church who were killed there when they got off their plane in San Salvador a number of years ago. They were, of course, just the tip of the iceberg of people who have committed themselves to Christ and leadership in the church. And so many of them have been women. Yep.
So these many, many new Christians and Muslims in the next 50 years, what are they transitioning from into these traditions?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And I am no expert. But in a place like Ethiopia, as we talked a little bit about yesterday, I mean, thanks to the Lutheran World Federation, by the way, people who are animists or who are just being born, I mean, a lot of people, the population is growing too, very rapidly. And the services given, say, by Evangelical Church Makane Yesu in Ethiopia are total services. I mean, there you got food. There is, even though the dictatorial government is cracking down and we have more of our Oromo, especially people in prison these days, this faith is catching people. The leader, Gudina Tumsa, if you remember him, went to Luther Seminary, 6'4", a big guy, was a good friend of mine for many, many years. He was the spirit. He walked from village to village as a young person, supported by the Swedish and then the American missionaries, and people looked up to this guy. Not only literally, but they saw him as the great, he represented the whole gospel to the whole person. So people found life sustenance, spiritually, materially, they found community. Some came also from Islam. That's a very difficult transition. And right now, you have the great divide. I met 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C. with the Oromo International Committee of the Church. About 200 leaders from all around the world, Germany, and all Oromo people. That is that tribal group within the Ethiopian community represents 40% of the Ethiopian people. They have really no representatives in the government. One of their leaders, Gudina Tumsa, had a chance. I mean, he's called the Dietrich Bonhoeffer of Africa. And he had a chance when the communists came in 1974 into Ethiopia. They were happy that Haile Selassie and the Amhara were gone, but this came in a horrible, horrible time of persecution. And Gudina had the chance to leave, like Bonhoeffer had the chance to stay in New York. Remember in those days where Henry Sloan Coffin said, "Dietrich, we have a place for you here at Union Theological Seminary." And Julius Nyerere, the great president of of Tanzania said, you can come, I will come and get you in an airplane. In fact, he sent his plane. He says, get out now. And Julius Nyerere was in the plane, waiting at the Addis Ababa airport. And Gudina says, I have called my pastors to stay with their flock. Now, I must stay with my flock. I can do no less than they have done. And, of course, that same night, he was taken after Bible study, after prayer meeting, and tortured, was killed, buried on the shallow grave in the presidential palace. When his grave was moved over to the cemetery after the communists were out, it was a big service. And his wife is still living, Sahai. His two daughters are really leaders of the church. Leaders of the church. The Gudina Tumsa Foundation in many parts of Ethiopia provides development and great service to the nomadic people, with special emphasis on the rights of girls and women. And if you go to visit that, which I recommend, you'll see something just rather fantastic. These girls who have been really pushed, and to get the fathers to say, okay, you can go to this school run by these Lutherans, well, that was huge. That was just huge. But the Gudina daughters persevered. Swedes came in to support. I mean, unfortunately, as you know, when the ELCA made the decision to accept gays and lesbians as part of its ministry, that was too much for all these African churches, and now the relationship to the Mekongese Church has been broken off. But the Church of Sweden has been broken off. The historic churches that supported this ministry in Africa, unfortunately, now we are in an unfortunate period. And when I went to this meeting 2 weeks ago, I was the only ELCA person anywhere near that convention. And we talked about this, because they want to be back in full communion, and I said, we do too. But this culturally, you know, was way beyond the pale for these people. So anyway, I just wanted to say, as a preface, that the role that the women have played in this revolution throughout the world is significant. You know, in our context, of course, when I went to the seminary, I mean, there were no women. So this has been fairly recent. I'm a pretty young guy. And and now, of course, half the student body at our seminaries are women. And they have come out of where? To lead this church. Now we have rules. You can't have a church council. You can't have a committee that is not at least 40-40 women and men. Lutheran World Federation, that represents about 80 million Lutherans around the world, is the largest of the evangelical churches. It has a rule that in all of its governing boards, there must be an equal distribution of men and women. Of course, there are other little quotas there too, to try to redress a tremendous imbalance. And it has brought such life. My pastor at our little congregation, Alexandria, Virginia, I mean, she is She was a doctor, then she, now she became a pastor with the Gettysburg Seminary. Jeanette Lisk, what a preacher, what a teacher. And then during, and what a ministry of this church. You know, I mean, I have to confess, I haven't been in jail too often, but last summer I was arrested and with her together in front of the White House because we were protesting the deportation of so many Central American friends in this wave of people being picked up. And we made our statement, but we paid a little price as well. But she was willing to do that. I mean, I'm expendable, but I mean, she was willing to stand up there for these people. And I said, wow, that is the image of the church today. And both of us protested, also in front of the White House, when the Ethiopian government a couple of months ago, well, about 6 months ago now, as you remember the story, when the young people from the Lutheran Church of Ethiopia were protesting the confiscation of lands of their parents around Addis Ababa by the government. They were protesting peacefully, and the government just shot 147 of them. You know, it made a little tiny story in the New York Times. But these were young, mainly women, but also men. And, you know, we were hoping that throughout the whole church, people would just rise up, you know, and say to our government, okay, we know you need a drone base there in Ethiopia, but that is not for the price of turning the other way. And of course, in the State Department, they know what's going on. They know all this that's happening. This is just the tip of the iceberg. But again, these are great women leadership emerging. Where have they been? Where have the women been? But as we talked a little bit yesterday, you know, it was about Luther. When you think of the Reformation, you think of Luther. Luther, of course, was an expert in economy. Historians have praised him. Even somebody like Karl Marx said he's the greatest political economist in the history of Germany. Can you believe this? So he knew a great deal about the copper industry, especially because that's where he grew up, in Mansfield, Germany, in the copper areas, where his father was a miner, wanted him then to lead. But we hear about Luther. But one of the major leaders of the economy of Luther's day was Katharina von Bora, Katie Luther. Luther's what? I mean, she masterminded the whole Reformation economy, and that was huge. He managed a huge farm. The Luthers had a huge farm. She was the manager of the brewery. You know, they produced that great Wittenberg beer right there outside the Luther house. She's the one who brought in the students to... So in recent years, of course, in Germany especially, Katie von Bora, Katie Luther, has been... And if you've been there, you see her statue now in the courtyard of the Luther House, Katie Luther. People know a little bit about Katie Luther, but they don't know about some of the other people, I don't know how many of these you know, of at the time, let me just go through it. Katie Luther, of course, is just amazing. Katharina Schutz-Zell became an evangelical pastor and traveled throughout, knew her Hebrew, taught Hebrew, and books have now been written about her. Ursula von Münsterberg, she was forced to flee the convent when she was caught smuggling in Luther's writings, but she became a Lutheran minister in the city of Strasbourg. Ursula von Münsterberg, that's the one. Anna Regius, born in Augsburg in 1505, she led most of the Bavarian student revolt in favor of Luther and the reformers came a lot of women. Although they didn't have their stature at the University of Regensburg or Ingolstadt or Münster, women read the works of Luther and they soon became quite prominent. Elisabeth Krusiger, Pomerania. I don't know if you've heard these. Then in France and in Switzerland, Ursula Jost, Marie Dentier, Jean d'Albret, and of course, and then in England, Jane Grey. I just mentioned her. She was very highly educated. She was only 16. She was a Lutheran. Great-granddaughter of Henry VIII, executed at the age of 16 because of her faith. And her relative, Katharina Willoughby of Suffolk, she was went around preaching the word of the Reformation, justification by grace through faith. Italy and I have a whole list. I don't know how many of those people you know. There's a great book out now by Kirsi Stierna. Does anybody know her? She was for many years in Gettysburg. One reason why, I think we have so many women in the seminaries in the USA. She has written a book called Women and the Reformation. There was an earlier book by the great Roland Bainton, Women of the Reformation. It wasn't a great book, but there was a great, I think, a first attempt to try to do the research in an area that where there hasn't been a great deal of research. But I want to say just a word, and then we have a little discussion today about one, I think, who is the most exciting of the leaders of the Reformation, Agula von Grumbach. I think Kirsi Stierna, I haven't seen her book, I don't know her, but I'm so pleased with that she has written also about Agula von Grumbach. The story starts in the 1520s, when the Reformation is spreading like wildfire throughout Germany, throughout Saxony, but it comes up against really hard times in Bayern, in what we call Bavaria. This is the solidly Roman Catholic stronghold. This is the place where Johannes Eck, who debated Luther at Leipzig, in the great debates of 1519. It was partly political, partly theological. This was the stronghold of the resistance about those Northerners, namely Philip Melanchthon and Martin Luther. But this was the day of the printing press, and so all of these works started to find their way from the printing press of Lucas von Cranach in Wittenberg and other printing houses now all over the place, in the Netherlands, in Scandinavia, all these tracts, and they were mainly pamphlets to begin with. And then, of course, the Bible is going to be translated. There were other versions around, and as we'll find, this already when she was 10 years of age, Argula, who was from a very unique baroness family, father was a baron. This was a unique category in German history of people answerable only to the emperor. So they had wealth to begin with. They had some wealth, and then they also had stature. But this the story happens when the church starts to really crack down on the Lutheran movement in southern Germany. If you've been to Regensburg or Ingolstadt, I mean, you'll see, of course, miles and miles of Audis, because that's where they make them. But this beautiful Bavarian rolling countryside. But it is because of the Counter-Reformation and the Council of Trent, it is still very firmly. I got off the train once at the little town of Beratzhausen, and I started asking people, it was sort of late in the day, I said, is there a statue of Argula von Grumbach? And they looked at me as if I was, an American or something. I mean, I started walking further into town, and I said, the statue of Argula, because I'd heard this, is there a statue of Argula von Grumbach? And they didn't know anybody. I got to City Hall, and it wasn't a good day, but there was somebody there who said, yes, there is a statue. You got to go way back up the hill there, several miles, and there you see, there is a little Lutheran church. You can imagine a Lutheran church in this place. But in the evening, anyway, I went up the hill, and I even took a picture of this that I'll just pass around and you can look at. The statue of Argula holding out the Bible. It's sort of more her silhouette because it's all I could manage. But I talked to the woman in charge of the church there, and it was a wonderful conversation. And she was so happy that somebody was interested in Argula von Grumbach. Most of the literature in the church told about this moment back in 1523, where the students gathered, young people gathered, to read Luther's writings. They talked about Luther, they talked about Melanchthon, they talked about the center of justification by grace through faith. I mean, it's amazing. The authorities were unhappy. They said, stop this immediately. And the gendarmes, they came and started arresting the students, picking them up. One of them, Arsatius Seehofer, was the student leader. And they physically abused him for having pamphlets from the Wittenberg group, Luther, and Melanchthon, and gave him stern warning. So if you do this again, you will be burned to the stake. Johannes Eck, the great Catholic leader, joined in with these people. And, the bottom line is that finally, they were going to take him away, as they did with Jan Hus, the Bohemian, the Moravian, 100 years earlier, they would, you know, they burned Johannes Hus to burn him at the stake for his faith. We're in full communion with the Moravian Church. Moravians and Lutherans are just the very same, absolutely the same. But they're the persecuted people who came from Bohemia and were rescued in Germany, and that whole story, how they came to be people all around the world now, who are the sort of forerunners of the Lutherans. Anyway, tearfully made his recantation. He had to do it publicly. They forced him. They said, no, I don't believe anything that Luther is saying. You know, he said all that. And then the authorities, from München to Ingolstadt to Regensburg, they were all relieved. But they had not reckoned with this young, brazen baroness by the name of Argula von Grumbach. She challenged these people publicly. She was so fit to be tied, so angry that they should do this to this young man. And she said to them, I'll just bring a quote, one of the quotes. She said, I do not flinch from appearing before you, from listening to you, from discussing with you. How in God's name and your university, does your university expect to prevail when you deploy such foolish violence against the word of God? When you force someone to hold the Holy Gospel in their hands for the very purpose of denying it, talking about Arsatius, as you did in the case of Arsatius Adolf, when you confront him with an oath and declaration such as this, and use imprisonment and even the threat of the stake to force him to deny Christ, what does this mean, to follow Jesus Christ? And what she said then became published. It went through all 14 editions. It went down through everywhere. And everybody wondered, who in the world is this? And of course, up in Wittenberg, the reformers asked, they sent delegations down there to talk to her. I mean, it's just a very young woman in her 20s. But after this moment, when she defended them, and they sort of backed down, and this was a whole string of events, public events. She was theologically acute. I mean, she knew what she was talking about. Her father had given her a Kronberger Bible when she was 10. She'd memorized huge sections of the Bible, and she knew what the heart of the Bible is, of God's grace in Jesus Christ for all people. And it was that simple. And she said, if Luther is going to say that, then I want to follow that. And this, of course, in a day when the merits and works righteousness and the whole economic system was geared in another direction. She began 8 years of correspondence with Martin Luther. We don't have those letters. We'll find them someday. I went down into the big libraries in Munich, and I found all kinds of stuff about that she had written, and compiled it. I mean, it's huge volumes. But she wrote in a very difficult old German script, And although I have photocopied all these pages, I can't read a page of it. A lot of what she has published, we have. We don't have Luther's response to her, but we do know from what Luther has said how he valued the ministry of Argula in Bavaria. Now, something happened. And Argula had a chance to meet Martin Luther. There was only one meeting ever in their course of their lives. It happened on June the 2nd in the year 1530. The place was the Coburg Castle. Anybody ever been to Coburg Castle? It's one of the most beautifully preserved monasteries. Not monasteries, but castles, a fortress right on the edge of the Thuringian forest in the north, or in the south, and the woods of Bavaria further to the south. Luther, of course, in the year 1530, this was when the Lutheran Church was born, when the delegation from Wittenberg went to Augsburg, to the Diet of the Estates of the Holy Roman Empire. There, Charles V was going to show up in person, and Philip Melanchthon was going to go and read the Augsburg Confession. Luther, of course, could not go. He was a criminal. He had been under the ban. Anybody who finds Luther could kill him with impunity. He could not go, and his protectors, of course, the princes of Hesse and Braunschweig and Magdeburg and, of course, Saxony, would not let him go. These were the same princes who, when Luther said, "Here I stand, I can do no other," at Worms, in 1521, you know, as he was leaving there, thinking of Jan Hus, the Moravian, the Bohemian, they kidnapped Luther on the trail. And if you know those stories, they grabbed him and took him up to the fortress castle of Wartburg above Eisenach, in this great castle, and there Luther lived for several years. It's where he translated the Bible. It's where a great deal of Lutheran theology was written. He had a fake identity there. Junker Georg, they called him. He grew a beard so that nobody would know that Martin Luther was there, because some of the princes on the other side, of course, would come to storm him to try to kill him. Anyway, Luther couldn't go to the greatest showdown in history between the Lutheran movement and the established church. We'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow night, if anybody is still alive and well tomorrow night. But at this moment, and Luther, he had become very famous, and yet all these people coming to see him, princes, Prince Philip of Hesse is going to come and see Martin Luther at the Coburg. I have a picture of the Coburg. It is one place, and there is a little room there in that place where Luther lived that you can go and see. Anyway, I thought I had a picture. There is the Coburg. You can see it, you know, for miles and miles in the distance, this towering. There are a couple photographs, or a postcard or something. I have a big placard too you can buy there. It's There he stayed at what they call the Blue Tower, and there he was under heavy protection. He said no to all these people wanting to come and see him, is just too much. But, and of course, he had his emissaries running back and forth between Augsburg and the castle, to find out what happened today. I mean, this was high drama in Augsburg as the Augsburg Confession was introduced. But he said, if the Argula von Grumbach wants to come, yes, by all means. You know, we don't know really what happened on that day. I can imagine what happened. Luther was very nervous. He'd never sort of encountered a woman theologian, a strong-minded woman theologian like this before. And word has it on the side that he was a little bit nervous on this day, but then he welcomed her. He welcomed her. And he talked about Arsatius Seehofer and the courageous stand of Argula on his behalf. And Luther thanked her. And she sent her son, Georg, to Wittenberg to be one of the students who lived with Melanchthons and Cranachs and the Luther in their houses while they learned theology. Georg was one of those. And she thanks Luther and Katie for receiving their son. By the way, Argula's husband was never very happy with what she did. He was very unhappy. And of course, just as Argula was put upon by the state, you know, this family lost all their status, all their money. He lost his whole position in the government. He never came around to support her and always said, back off of this Luther thing. But she says, no, I'm sorry. And that is another story in itself. But she is going to Augsburg. She's going with the delegation of Philip Melanchthon and Justus Jonas and Johannes Bugenhagen. She is one of these people going with the Lutheran delegation there. And she says, I will talk to Charles V to his face. I mean, of course, word has it that when they read the Augsburg Confession, Charles fell asleep. Of course, it is a long document. Not too difficult to believe. But that wasn't, of course, the point. This was the Augsburg Confession. There would be no, it had to do with the unity of the empire, Holy Roman Empire. And the key to the unity of the Holy Roman Empire was the unity of the church. If there was no unity of the church, you're going to have these Lutheran princes from the north battling the Roman Catholic armies to the south, which of course later happened. But so everybody wanted to get some sort of a unity. And if you read the Augsburg Confession, you know, it is the most accommodating statement of faith that, we'll talk about that tomorrow. Pope Francis likes the Augsburg Confession. Can you believe it? Pope Francis likes the Augsburg Confession. And that is something rather phenomenal. But Argula's going to go there, and she is going to talk. But I can imagine, in the course of this meeting, Argula says to Luther, Martin, I know you've been thinking about me, but Martin, I have to ask you this. Why did you not support me publicly? Why didn't, in all of this controversy, didn't I hear this word of solidarity from you? I mean, I'm just imagining at the moment. But if you listen to that conversation, there's a point at which I think Luther says, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about this. You know, Luther is always thinking, and his world is also male dominated. You know, he is no great liberating soul in many respects either, so we can't turn him into something he wasn't. But I can imagine, because after that he is very strong publicly in support of Argula von Grumbach and from the other women whose names I have mentioned. We all know, of course, Luther's debate with Henry VIII and the letter exchange between them and the Lutherans in Great Britain, in the UK, in England, that is, who had a very, very hard time. The names that I have mentioned. But Luther's response after this meeting was to be much more in support of women's ministry. Didn't talk then about the ordination of women, but Luther, if you read his treatise on the priesthood of all believers, broke down those distinctions that later came back again, the Missouri Synod. He said, we are all priests. I mean, that was the revolution. It's not that everyone's their own priest, but we're all priests to each other. The same status. The shoemaker before his workbench has the same status in the eyes of God as the pastor standing before the communion table. In this very hierarchical world, Luther just broke down those distinctions immediately. I was disappointed when I went to the seminary and learned this. But it was, you have no higher status than a mechanic out at Holden Village, person working on the bricks in the wall, people driving the ox cart, the bartender there at the tavern right next to Luther's home. You all have in the eyes, we all have the same calling, namely to love God and to serve our neighbor. We are all called with the same vocation. We have different jobs, but our vocation is one, to love God and to serve our neighbor, to engage in what we called yesterday the liturgy after the liturgy. That liturgy is conducted not by priests of the church, it is the lay people of the church continuing the same service. As they say in German, the Gottesdienst, the service of God, continues now. As soon as you leave that church, it is part and parcel of the worship that continues throughout the week. I don't know that Argula ever met Martin Luther again. There's really no evidence. But if you want to know more about this story, a book has now been written by a British guy Arulafan Guru Maharaj. That is just a beautiful, beautiful story. You can Google that and buy the book. I was so, I mean, that's, this is not my field, but I was so enraptured by that that I took this train ride to see this little Lutheran church in this place where this statue of Argula is. I was so excited about this, and then to talk about it. Actually, I've written a little bit about it, a play. And if anybody wants to have this play to use in their congregation, fine. But Argula said to Johannes Eck, she said, if you take me and burn me at the stake, I am persuaded that if I am given grace even to suffer death in Christ's name, many hearts will be awakened. Yes, and whereas I have written on my own, I say 100 women will emerge to follow me. That's a powerful statement by her. And look around, and I tell you, that has been fulfilled in our lifetime. I'm a fan of Argulafan Gumba. But let me ask, why has it been this long for the church to think about people like Argulafan Gumba? I mean, this is all recent stuff. Why has it taken the church so long to see the implications of the priesthood of all believers in the question of ordination? It's the same question I asked yesterday. Why has it taken people so long to discover what we have called the forgotten Luther? The Luther of vast social and economic reforms. I may have gone a little bit too far yesterday in calling him the Bernie Sanders of the 16th century, but...
No, I thought you called Bernie Sanders the Luther.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you for that. The sweeping, the whole tradition of social democracy in Europe is Martin Luther. The whole idea, I mean, in all these countries, and I'm not going to make any more of a case for it, in all of these countries, there's freedom of speech, freedom of gathering, freedom of worship, freedom of faith, freedom of everything, but everybody has food. Everybody has health care. The Krankenkasse in Germany. If you have an accident in Germany, don't worry about it. Everybody has education. Send your kids there to Germany to school in English. It'll cost you absolutely nothing because that is the entitlement. And if you get health care, social security, food, education, to say nothing about the arts and theater, that is what everybody by their right has coming to them in these countries. In this country, it's so difficult even to go to school. Kids come out of school with all this debt. I mean, how bad is that? Anyway, I'm trying to sell more copies of Forgotten Luther, and here's a little pamphlet from Lutheran University Press. This book is about a month old now, but it will also be soon online. That people can tune in and watch videos of the lectures given by Carter Lindbergh, the great historian of the Lutheran Church, Cynthia Molibita, who, of course, one of the rising theological stars of the Lutheran Church. Now at, where does she teach? Out there in Berkeley, together with Kiersey Sternia. She went from Gettysburg, now they're both there at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley. John Paul, probably the
classmate of mine.
What's that?
He's a classmate of mine at Trinity Seminary.
John Paul, really?
Yes.
You know, I just met him, and he gave a lecture that's in this book about the catechisms. That is absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's just an eye opener to me.
He's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, thank you for that, John Paul. So you can see him lecture if you click on the link, the Forgotten Luther. I mean, you can go Forgotten Luther Facebook page, and there you can link on to, and you can find out where you can buy the book. And who else? Trinity Seminary, Tim Hoffman,
yeah,
retiring. Mm-hmm. Now this guy started out as sort of a Luther. I mean, he did stuff on the Reformation, asked what mission went, then he got taken up in Latin America liberation theology. And he could see the role of Martin Luther and the Reform, their role in at least converging with this movement that came from, of course, the Second Vatican Council and Gutierrez and a lot of other Roman Catholic theologians. But then you got Walter Altmann, the Lutheran liberation theologian, and many others. And I should mention, too, Philip Anderson, I don't know if anybody knows him, with whom I've worked for years in Guatemala, El Salvador, and I've seen him gather Mayan Indians in the mountain top and have services of prayer together at the time of the great violence in those countries. Phil Anderson, I mention him because he's now come back from El Salvador, and I think the doctors give him a couple of weeks to live. He's in hospice care now in Minneapolis, but so keep Philip in your prayers if you would. I mean, he's one of the great pastors of the church, and I could tell stories as could Tim Hoffman about Phil Anderson for hours. Why has it taken us so long? Has this been a good thing? The women leadership in the church? Ordination of women? Has it been a good,
yes,
your experience? Yeah?
Well, it's the salvation of the church.
Well, that's not understatement. Yeah, okay. It's the salvation of the church. Well, that's a pretty strong statement.
If you believe God calls women, then yes, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe God does.
Yeah. I mean, you're a deaconess,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, what a great tradition. The deaconesses, like in the Roman Catholic Church, some of them have given their lives in this ministry.
Oh, yes.
You know, and you know that history. To bring that deaconess history into the mainstream, I think is a huge thing. I don't know who's writing that history, but I know stories of individual people in the deaconess movement. And of course that's in Germany and from the intermission movement. The deaconess is very strong in Germany. Work with disabled people, work in hospitals, pioneering work that recognize those in Lutheran fashion as part of the priesthood of all believers and accord them the recognition that is due. And for young people, you know, I would think this would be inspiration. I know we have a few people here going to the seminary now. I don't know where they are. This is, I guess, a working camp, but going to the seminary now. What will they expect? What are their hopes and dreams? What is their inspiration? Why are they there? I mean, I've been one of those as a pastor, encouraging not everybody, but individual people to become, to go to the seminary. I went to this, I wasn't planning to go to the seminary, but I found a program of people who, for people who are confused, I guess. They had these people where they give you a year if you think about ministry. And I thought, whoa, how cool is that? You know, they'd pay everything and no strings attached, you didn't have to, you just had to think about it. And so I spent a year in Union Seminary, and it's called in New York City, and it just blew me away, just blew me away. And I said, well, I'm a Lutheran, maybe I'll go to Lutheran St. Paul. And I tried to transfer, and they said, no, sorry. Anyway, that's a long story, but I finally got in, and so went to seminary, Lutheran Seminary. But I mean, I wouldn't recommend it for everybody. On Lutheran terms, you don't have to be a pastor to be a minister, to be a priest, of course.
In terms of your question about was it worth it? I mean, is it, you know, how, why so long? I think of the great loss that people who came, I was in seminary when we celebrated the 10th year of the anniversary of the ordination of women in 1980, so the first ordination was in 1970. Mm-hmm. But the conversations that we didn't have in those seminaries in the years previous to that, that was beginning to change if you looked at the picture of my graduation class. I mean, it's still predominantly men, but it's probably 25% women. Oh. Some of them were, they brought so much to the table that we didn't hear before. And it's because of places like Holden that, you know, ordains Nancy Winder so many years ago, back when it wasn't common practice. Having women there and valuing their role in the history, you talked about somebody I knew nothing at all about until today. We missed that.
What was your seminary?
Trinity.
What?
I was at Trinity.
Oh, thanks for that.
So I think that we've benefited so much from the leadership that we've had, because they bring more, a different perspective, just getting more perspectives at the table, and not the paternalistic, almost, it's my, I'm male because I'm entitled to this role as hair pastor.
As I confessed yesterday, I gave some lectures in 1978, I guess some 12 or 13. They're still in the archives when I was talking about South Africa and Namibia and Eastern Europe and all kinds of things. It's such a humbling experience, because not so much about the subject matter, but about your more chauvinistic language. You know, you don't realize that you preached. You know, you look at old sermons, not a good idea, but it's, you know, and oh, it is, you know, you say, God forgive me for this. Because there were some women around who alerted you, but you didn't pay that much attention. So it's been a liberating experience, you know, for men.
I think that extends into, and maybe in defense of my learning out that it's a salvation, but it extends into a representation of God herself, because it broadens our understanding of the image of God and the feminine in the divinity.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And if you have... yeah, I think one could have a, you know, I read this book by Mary Daly about the names for God. I mean, when you go into Luther, the one thing I like about Luther, and this is just a little parenthesis, is that Luther said about nature and about history, the finite is capable of bearing the infinite. Finitum capax infinity. Over against the Catholic side, it said finitum non capax infinity. You have to change the bread and the wine into the body and blood. Luther said no. He said, in and with, under the bread and wine, Christ speaks to you. In other words, in nature and in history and art, you have to be able to see through something. It's, if you take it only as face value, then you are missing the whole point. So with the names of God, with the name of God, our Father who art in heaven, you know, as Paul Tillich once said, God is a symbol for God. I thought that was a profound statement. I'm not sure what it means, but he was saying God, the name, it's not that. God is a symbol for that, the infinite, the absolute, that which is beyond time. You know, that which grasps us. Faith is being grasped by this ultimate concern. And then you use what you have in language to try to describe things that are ultimately undescribable. So Luther is out for people to try to get new eyes to see what is beyond. And as we talked yesterday a little bit about the mythos, in the best terms, the stories of the Bible, you can't just take them, or the miracles, for example, you can't just take them for face value and say, wow, what a neat trick he did turning water into wine. You got to say, what is that, the meaning of that? We're dealing with the transformation. The old is becoming new. Something has got to grasp you in that. That's why the word for miracle is basically in St. John's Gospel, I remember, semeion, which really means a symbol or a sign. Don't say only a symbol, because that's where the truth is. That's where the power is. This is Martin Luther. And so when you get to the biblical language about the names for God, you also have to come and say that, you know, our theology, it comes late. It is a reflection of what goes on before. We're not saved by theology. We're not saved by doctrines. We're saved by God's grace through faith in Christ. So that's a longer discussion, but thank you very much. And I'm running over my time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.